It's the 5th of December 2014. This is the listening part of the 5th Latgale Open English Language Olympiad. It will consist of 4 tasks. You will hear the text twice. Task 1. You have a minute to read the task.
MTV unquestionably revolutionized the music industry. The network debuted in 1981 to a few thousand households on a single cable system. It finished the year with nearly 21 million subscribers. In addition to its music programming, MTV has a long history of promoting social, political, and environmental activism. In doing so, it has come under fire from both liberal and conservative media watchdogs, as well as religious groups over issues such as censorship, political correctness, and perceived negative moral influence on young people. MTV became the first to run TV spots promoting safe sex and AIDS awareness, issues considered far too controversial for major broadcast networks. It also addressed the problem of substance abuse with a series of Just Say No anti-drug spots and a Rock Against Drugs campaign. MTV entered the political arena when it launched the Choose or Lose campaign to get students politically involved by increasing voter registration. Fight for Your Rights championed the causes of anti-violence and anti-discrimination. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and MTV teamed up to form Think Education, encouraging students to graduate from high school and be prepared for the responsibilities of college and work. The channel also aired a series of pro-conservation ads called Break the Addiction, advocating reduced energy consumption. MTV continues to address current political issues. Think MTV, the network's vehicle for social activism, invites young people to choose the issues that resonate most and take action to make a positive change.
You have a minute now to check your work, then you will hear the text a second time.
MTV unquestionably revolutionized the music industry. The network debuted in 1981 to a few thousand households on a single cable system. It finished the year with nearly 21 million subscribers. In addition to its music programming, MTV has a long history of promoting social, political, and environmental activism. In doing so, it has come under fire from both liberal and conservative media watchdogs, as well as religious groups over issues such as censorship, political correctness, and perceived negative moral influence on young people. MTV became the first to run TV spots promoting safe sex and AIDS awareness, issues considered far too controversial for major broadcast networks. It also addressed the problem of substance abuse with a series of Just Say No anti-drug spots and a Rock Against Drugs campaign. MTV entered the political arena when it launched the Choose or Lose campaign to get students politically involved by increasing voter registration. Fight for Your Rights championed the causes of anti-violence and anti-discrimination. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and MTV teamed up to form Think Education, encouraging students to graduate from high school and be prepared for the responsibilities of college and work. The channel also aired a series of pro-conservation ads called Break the Addiction, advocating reduced energy consumption. MTV continues to address current political issues. Think MTV, the network's vehicle for social activism, invites young people to choose the issues that resonate most and take action to make a positive change.
There is a minute now to finish the task. There is the end of task 1. Go on to task 2. Task 2. You have a minute to read the task.
Regular listeners to these podcasts know that Richard comes from the Isle of Man. But for this week's podcast on English.com, we're talking to Robert, who comes from Jersey. Is that right, Robert?
Yes, indeed.
Okay, could you first of all just tell us where is Jersey?
Well, Jersey is the largest of a group of islands known as the Channel Islands. That's the English title. They're variously known as either les Îles de la Manche, islands of the Channel, or, as a source of history, Les Îles Anglo-Normandes.
Right. So they sound like they're quite near to France, then?
Yes. They are situated in the Bay of St. Malo. It's 30 miles south to the port of St. Malo and 12 miles east to Granville.
Okay, but these aren't French islands.
No. They were originally as part of the Duchy of Normandy.
What language do they speak on the islands then?
Well, now, of course, it's mostly English. And although it's a multi-language society now, in the sense that we've got Italians, French, Portuguese, and that more recently Polish, the traditional Jersey language is in fact a Norman patois, known as Jersey French.
Jersey French. And do many people speak that nowadays?
No. There's an attempt at reviving it, and they now have classes in both the elementary and secondary schools on a voluntary basis, so they're trying to preserve the language.
And are many of the young people interested in learning that language?
Surprisingly, yes. There are quite a few young people who delight in being able to talk amongst themselves in a language which nobody else understands.
Yes, I can see that would be useful. Tell me about the name Jersey. When I think of the word Jersey, I always think of the jumper, the pullover. Is there a connection with that?
A very strong connection, because years ago, Middle Ages on, Jersey was famous for its knitting. And in fact, the whole population knitted, men, women and children, everybody knitted. And that was where the name Jersey came from.
Ah, okay. So, obviously, Jersey and the Channel Islands are quite south then. Do you have many tourists in the summer?
Jersey had a very large and thriving tourist industry, I suppose from the 1920s onwards, but it has changed dramatically. And the advent of cheap flights to sunny places, and although Jersey is a little further south, it isn't. You can't guarantee the sunshine.
Well, you can in Spain.
Well, you can in Spain, and it is often cheaper to fly to Spain than it is to Jersey.
But you do have tourists coming in the summer. What's the main attraction for tourists coming to Jersey?
The main attraction, I think, and of course Jersey Tourism has been plugging this, is the beauty of the island, the unspoilt nature of the island, and of course all the historic things. We have some marvellous castles, and then as a result of the German occupation, there are all sorts of interesting German bunkers, a big underground hospital, now a major tourist centre.
Mm. And there's something called the Battle of Flowers, isn't there? Can you explain what that is?
It's no longer a battle. This is a large procession of coloured floats made either of natural flowers, and they can be...
What do you mean by a float?
Motor-driven. Imagine a big lorry, and then you build a framework on it and then cover it completely in flowers.
Right.
Or you have modelled animals, all sorts of things, dancing girls, music, and it becomes a long procession along the main front road. The battle name comes from the early days when originally, at the end of the procession, everybody tore the flowers, and they were mainly hydrangeas, and they tore them apart, and the whole thing was wrecked within a matter of an hour.
Okay, and then this has developed into this.
But now it is a beautiful procession, and it is followed the next day by an evening lit procession with the same floats, but they're all lit up.
Oh, that sounds nice. And I do know that Jersey is also famous for its zoo. Am I right about that?
Yes, the emphasis is not on zoo now. This is Durrell's Park. Wildlife Preservation is the main name.
And that's Gerald Durrell, who some people might know, wrote books including My Family and Other Animals.
And now it has its own training centre, and it trains people from all around the world. And it's had some successes in maintaining endangered species like the parrot from St. Lucia. They're very proud that Jersey has enabled them to keep their parrot, and the same for animals in Madagascar.
Right. Okay. What's your favourite part of the island? Your favourite place to go to?
Oh, there are many, many favourites, really. I think because I like scuba diving, I go to the north of the island, and there's Bully Bay. Because the north of the island is largely cliff-formed, but there was this little bay there. Okay, it's only got a pebble beach, but the fantastic scuba diving.
So you're saying
there.
It's not sandy there, then?
It's not sandy on that particular one.
Right.
You have to go to the south or to the east and west of the island to get sandy beaches.
So it's a pebble beach, but you like it because?
Because it is enclosed and it has a great variety of fish and crabs and things like that, all sorts of things to discover underwater. And then about a mile offshore, there's a famous wreck which you can dive down onto.
Great, okay. Thank you very much, Robert. Sounds fascinating.
Be my pleasure.
You have a minute now to check your work, then you will hear the text a second time.
Regular listeners to these podcasts know that Richard comes from the Isle of Man. But for this week's podcast on English.com, we're talking to Robert, who comes from Jersey. Is that right, Robert?
Yes, indeed.
Okay, could you first of all just tell us, where is Jersey?
Well, Jersey is the largest of a group of islands known as the Channel Islands. That's the English title. They're variously known as either Les Îles de la Manche, Islands of the Channel, or, as a source of history, Les Îles Anglo-Normandes.
Right. So they sound like they're quite near to France, then?
Yes. They are situated in the Bay of St. Malo. It's 30 miles south to Port of St. Malo and 12 miles east to Granville.
Okay, but these aren't French islands.
No. They were originally as part of the Duchy of Normandy.
What language do they speak on the islands, then?
Well, now, of course, it's mostly English. And although it's a multi-language society now, in the sense that we've got Italians, French, Portuguese, and that more recently Polish, the traditional Jersey language is, in fact, a Norman patois, known as Jersey French.
Jersey French. And do many people speak that nowadays?
No. There's an attempt at reviving it, and they now have classes in both the elementary and secondary schools on a voluntary basis, so they're trying to preserve the language.
And are many of the young people interested in learning that language?
Surprisingly, yes. There are quite a few young people who delight in being able to talk amongst themselves in a language which nobody else understands.
Yes, I can see that would be useful. Tell me about the name Jersey. When I think of the word Jersey, I always think of the jumper, the pullover. Is there a connection with that?
A very strong connection, because years ago, Middle Ages on, Jersey was famous for its knitting. And in fact, the whole population knitted, men, women and children. Everybody knitted. And that was where the name Jersey came from.
Ah, okay. So, obviously, Jersey and the Channel Islands are quite south, then. Do you have many tourists in the summer?
Jersey had a very large and thriving tourist industry, from the 1920s onwards, but it has changed dramatically. And the advent of cheap flights to sunny places, and although Jersey is a little further south, it isn't. You can't guarantee the sunshine.
Well, you can in Spain.
Well, you can in Spain, and it is often cheaper to fly to Spain than it is to Jersey.
But you do have tourists coming in the summer. What's the main attraction for tourists coming to Jersey?
The main attraction, I think, and of course Jersey Tourism has been plugging this, is the beauty of the island, the unspoilt nature of the island, and of course all the historic things. We have some marvellous castles, and then as a result of the German occupation, there are all sorts of interesting German bunkers, a big underground hospital, now a major tourist centre.
Mm. And there's something called the Battle of Flowers, isn't there? Can you explain what that is?
It's no longer a battle. This is a large procession of coloured floats made either of natural flowers, and they can be...
What do you mean by a float?
Motor-driven... Imagine a big lorry, and then you build a framework on it and then cover it completely in flowers.
Right.
Or you have modelled animals, all sorts of things, dancing girls, music, and it becomes a long procession along the main front road. The battle name comes from the early days when originally, at the end of the procession, everybody tore the flowers, and they were mainly hydrangeas, and they tore them apart, and the whole thing was wrecked within a matter of an hour.
Okay, and then this has developed into this.
But now it is a beautiful procession, and it is followed the next day by an evening lit procession with the same floats, but they're all lit up.
Oh, that sounds nice. And I do know that Jersey is also famous for its zoo. Am I right about that?
Yes. The emphasis is not on zoo now. This is Durrell's Park. Wildlife Preservation is the main aim.
And that's Gerald Durrell, who some people might know, wrote books including My Family and Other Animals.
And now it has its own training centre, and it trains people from all around the world. And it's had some successes in maintaining endangered species like the parrot from St. Lucia. They're very proud that Jersey has enabled them to keep their parrot, and the same for animals in Madagascar.
Right. Okay. What's your favourite part of the island? Your favourite place to go to?
Oh, there are many, many favourites, really. I think because I like scuba diving, I go to the north of the island, and there's Bully Bay. Because the north of the island is largely cliff formed, but there's this little bay there. Okay, it's only got a pebble beach, but the fantastic scuba diving.
So you're saying
there.
It's not sandy there then?
It's not sandy on that particular one.
Right.
You have to go to the south or to the east and west of the island to get sandy beaches.
So it's a pebble beach, but you like it because?
Because it is enclosed, and it has a great variety of fish and crabs and things like that, all sorts of things to discover underwater. And then about a mile offshore, there's a famous wreck which you can dive down onto.
Great, okay. Thank you very much, Robert. Sounds fascinating.
Be my pleasure.
There is a minute now to finish the task. This is the end of task 2. Go on to task 3. Task 3. You have a minute to read the task.
Well, the first thing to say about marine photography is that it's not as easy as it might look. Actually, taking photos is only a part of it, because you have to organise a boat and crew and everything. Forward planning is actually the key to my work, and without that I'd never pick up a camera because I wouldn't know what I was aiming for. Another important aspect is doing drawings, which show roughly what the photograph will contain. If I do that first, it means I'm more likely to capture it on film. And because I've decided beforehand what pictures I want, I'm in a position to select the appropriate equipment. It's all part of the process. I mean, not everybody goes about it as I do, I know, and some people say that I'm ruling out the creative side of photography by working in this way. But in fact, the opposite is true. Because my aim is for every photo to depict something new, I need to think about how I'm going to achieve that. Otherwise, I'd just go home with the same photos every time. It's also important to remember that marine photography is not only about what you might want to get as pictures. The seas where you find whales and dolphins are often protected, so you need to check whether you need to get official permission to photograph there. So that means leaving enough time to apply in advance to the relevant authorities. So, well, eventually I find myself at sea, and that's where the real excitement starts. Most of the time I'll be in a boat, often quite a small one, and of course they don't stay very still at the best of times, and quite a few potentially great photos have been ruined by sudden storms when you just can't get the photos you want. The other challenge is to prevent water damage to my cameras, so I usually keep them in a plastic food container, which is watertight, even if it doesn't look entirely professional. And the results? Well, because I travel a lot, I'm rarely at home, so my son keeps most of my photos in his house so I can see them there if I want. I'm really delighted when photos are accepted by magazines, because they then reach a wider public than in an exhibition or if I do a commission for a book.
Now you'll hear part two again.
Well, the first thing to say about marine photography is that it's not as easy as it might look. Actually, taking photos is only a part of it, because you have to organise a boat and crew and everything. Forward planning is actually the key to my work, and without that I'd never pick up a camera because I wouldn't know what I was aiming for. Another important aspect is doing drawings, which show roughly what the photograph will contain. If I do that first, it means I'm more likely to capture it on film. And because I've decided beforehand what pictures I want, I'm in a position to select the appropriate equipment. It's all part of the process. I mean, not everybody goes about it as I do, I know, and some people say that I'm ruling out the creative side of photography by working in this way. But in fact, the opposite is true. Because my aim is for every photo to depict something new, I need to think about how I'm going to achieve that. Otherwise, I'd just go home with the same photos every time. It's also important to remember that marine photography is not only about what you might want to get as pictures. The seas where you find whales and dolphins are often protected, so you need to check whether you need to get official permission to photograph there. So that means leaving enough time to apply in advance to the relevant authorities. So, well, eventually I find myself at sea, and that's where the real excitement starts. Most of the time I'll be in a boat, often quite a small one, and of course they don't stay very still at the best of times, and quite a few potentially great photos have been ruined by sudden storms when you just can't get the photos you want. The other challenge is to prevent water damage to my cameras, so I usually keep them in a plastic food container, which is watertight, even if it doesn't look entirely professional. And the results? Well, because I travel a lot, I'm rarely at home, so my son keeps most of my photos in his house so I can see them there if I want. I'm really delighted when photos are accepted by magazines, because they then reach a wider public than in an exhibition or if I do a commission for a book.
There is a minute now to finish the task. This is the end of task 3. Go on to task 4. Task 4. You have a minute to read the task.
Speaker 1.
People always think I should be the fittest person around. I mean, here I am in the gym with all these machines just ready and waiting for me to use them. But in reality, there's very little time for that. You see, I open up for the early birds at 7, and then once the business types have moved on to the office, it's time to help the mums and senior citizens to flex their muscles. Then I grab a sandwich for lunch, and, well, the day just rolls on with more of the same till late-ish in the evening. Don't get me wrong, I really like the predictability of it, but as for sorting out my own programme, no chance.
Speaker 2.
Every year, when spring comes around, I'm called in and told to send off for the brochures on all the gyms in the area. Let's face it, she could ask her children to do that. And she's so casual about it. That's what gets me. Just assumes I have nothing better to do. It's ridiculous, because 3 weeks later all the brochures are gathering dust, and a week after that they end up in the bin. It's not part of my job to make sure other people are fit or tidy up after them. But all this takes up valuable time, which means I can't get on with collating the reports for meetings, and then I have to stay late. It's so thoughtless.
Speaker 3.
Much as I'd like to say I'm very fit, the fact is I have to keep an eye on my blood pressure. That's doctor's orders, and I'm slightly overweight. It's a lifestyle thing, I suppose. If I'm office-based, I'm there well before the secretary gets in because I need to plan my day. But invariably, I'm travelling, spending a lot of time sitting around. If I know I've got a long day of meetings and presentations to clients, I force myself to go for a run round the park at lunchtime. But that's the best I can do. Last year, I paid vast sums of money to join a very smart gym, but I was really just subsidising the owner's pension because I never had time to go.
Speaker 4.
The fact is that by the time I've got up, sorted out my daughter Lucy, been to the studio, done some work on my ongoing project, picked Lucy up from school and got home, there's very little time for me to concentrate on keeping fit. At least in my work, no 2 days are the same. Luckily, Lucy isn't fussy about food, so we eat a pretty balanced diet, but nothing too trendy. And 3 evenings a week I get a babysitter in and do as many lengths of the local pool as I can possibly manage. I'm determined to try to keep that up.
Speaker 5.
For most of my life, I've been listening to people giving me their half-baked theories on keeping fit. It's just like water off a duck's back now. I must confess, I hardly even listen anymore. As far as I'm concerned, it doesn't matter whether the latest thing is yoga or mud baths or vitamin supplements. What's important is doing everything in moderation, and that includes diet and exercise. If more people took that to heart, my surgery would be a lot less crowded, I can tell you.
Now you'll hear part 4 again. Speaker 1.
People always think I should be the fittest person around. I mean, here I am in the gym with all these machines just ready and waiting for me to use them. But in reality, there's very little time for that. You see, I open up for the early birds at 7, and then once the business types have moved on to the office, it's time to help the mums and senior citizens to flex their muscles. Then I grab a sandwich for lunch, and, well, the day just rolls on with more of the same till late-ish in the evening. Don't get me wrong, I really like the predictability of it, but as for sorting out my own programme, no chance.
Speaker 2.
Every year, when spring comes around, I'm called in and told to send off for the brochures on all the gyms in the area. Let's face it, she could ask her children to do that. And she's so casual about it. That's what gets me. Just assumes I have nothing better to do. It's ridiculous, because 3 weeks later all the brochures are gathering dust, and a week after that they end up in the bin. It's not part of my job to make sure other people are fit or tidy up after them. But all this takes up valuable time, which means I can't get on with collating the reports for meetings, and then I have to stay late. It's so thoughtless.
Speaker 3.
Much as I'd like to say I'm very fit, the fact is I have to keep an eye on my blood pressure. That's doctor's orders, and I'm slightly overweight. It's a lifestyle thing, I suppose. If I'm office-based, I'm there well before the secretary gets in because I need to plan my day. But invariably, I'm travelling, spending a lot of time sitting around. If I know I've got a long day of meetings and presentations to clients, I force myself to go for a run round the park at lunchtime. But that's the best I can do. Last year, I paid vast sums of money to join a very smart gym, but I was really just subsidising the owner's pension because I never had time to go.
Speaker 4.
The fact is that by the time I've got up, sorted out my daughter Lucy, been to the studio, done some work on my ongoing project, picked Lucy up from school and got home, there's very little time for me to concentrate on keeping fit. At least in my work, no 2 days are the same. Luckily, Lucy isn't fussy about food, so we eat a pretty balanced diet, but nothing too trendy. And 3 evenings a week I get a babysitter in and do as many lengths of the local pool as I can possibly manage. I'm determined to try to keep that up.
Speaker 5.
For most of my life, I've been listening to people giving me their half-baked theories on keeping fit. It's just like water off a duck's back now. I must confess, I hardly even listen anymore. As far as I'm concerned, it doesn't matter whether the latest thing is yoga or mud baths or vitamin supplements. What's important is doing everything in moderation, and that includes diet and exercise. If more people took that to heart, my surgery would be a lot less crowded, I can tell you.
There is a minute now to finish the task. This is the end of the listening part of the Olympiad.